From NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to start off the week by taking another look at the future of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Interim VA Secretary Sloan Gibson, a former West Point grad and a retired banker, is leading the department after Secretary Eric Shinseki submitted his resignation. And that came, as you probably remember, after weeks of disturbing reports that secret wait lists were created at a number of VA facilities to hide how long veterans were actually waiting for care. This has obviously been an embarrassing time for the VA. But some say the crisis also offers an opportunity to reshape the VA to better serve the nation's veterans. So we wondered what this would look like. To find out, we've called upon Ed Dorn. He's a former Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. He's now a professor of public policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's with us from member station KUT in Austin. Welcome back, Professor Dorn. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
Also joining us for additional perspective is Michael Cannon. He is the director of health policy studies with the Cato Institute. That's a libertarian think tank here in Washington, D.C. And he's here with us in our D.C. studios. Welcome back to you, Michael Cannon.
Thank you, Michelle.
So, Professor Dorn, I'm going to start with you. And I do want to emphasize that I do understand that there's a handoff from the Defense Department to the Veterans Administration when a person leaves active duty. But I did want to ask if you have any immediate thoughts about what Sloan Gibson should do right now to deal with this scandal.
Well, he's doing, and the Congress is doing, the urgent things, which are increasing the resources so that you can shorten those wait times. He also, over the longer term, needs to take a look at the metrics they're using. One of the real problems you have whenever you're running an organization is figuring out what to measure. And in the VA, what turned out was that they may not have been measuring quite the right things. They also seem, at least in some offices, to have had a big problem with people gaming the system. And that's the scandal, the lack of integrity of some of the managers.
Is this an integrity issue of the managers, or is it that they were just given an impossible task? I mean, was it that they simply could not meet the targets and had no way to express that?
There are ways to express that in any organization, and one of the problems is that in any management system, you have some people who find it easier just to go along with the program, and even when that means falsifying a few things, than it is to stand up and risk being penalized. So there is, at least in a few offices in the VA, clearly an integrity problem.
Michael Cannon, I understand you have some thoughts about the future, but I did want to ask you the same question. You know, the House Veterans Affairs Committee is hosting hearings today about the troubles at the VA, and I just briefly wanted to ask, what do you hope comes out of that?
Well, it's hard to come up with anything that they can do, that the new acting secretary can do to fix these problems beyond transparency, because he just doesn't have the authority, and he really is given an impossible task. You've got Congress not funding the Department of Veterans Affairs adequately, and how is it someone supposed to meet all the commitments that Congress has made to veterans without adequate funding? And there are all the challenges of trying to centrally plan services for so many different people in so many locations without the mechanisms that the markets use in order to move resources from one place to the next.
In fact, this is one of your points. Your point is that Congress is part of the problem here, that Congress plays a very big role here. And you're saying that part of the problem is not the VA itself, but that Congress does not take the full cost of war into account in the decision-making process all down the line. Talk a little bit more about
your point of view on this. Well, that's right. Everyone is upset about, and should be upset about, the horrific revelations that we've been getting out of the Veterans Administration. 100,000 veterans are waiting for care. There are even allegations that these waits have caused or contributed to their deaths. There's a much bigger scandal at play here, though. And that is that, yes, the Department of Veterans Affairs mistreats sick and disabled veterans who show up on its doorstep. But more fundamentally, the agency's very existence hides from Congress some of the most expensive costs of going to war, the long-term costs of veterans benefits. And because of that, because the structure of the Department of Veterans Affairs allows Congress to hide those costs, Congress is more likely to go to war. So the existence of the Department of Veterans Affairs actually lead to, increases the likelihood of more dead and disabled veterans mistreats them.
I mean, are you saying, I don't understand your point. I mean, obviously the country, going back to the days, you know, some of the very early days of the Republic, has made a commitment to its veterans. And so how are you saying that that commitment should be expressed?
Well, what Congress does not do is it does not pre-fund those commitments. It says we're going to go to war now. We'll pay those costs later. Imagine a system where Congress had to pay those costs up front. If
recognizing that those costs are going to exist.
That they are going to exist. Okay. Take the Iraq War. In 2002, Congress was debating the authorization, authorizing the Bush administration to invade Iraq. There were estimates, some by the Bush administration's own officials, that that would cost $200 billion. The invasion would cost $200 billion. That was such a sensitive issue, the cost of the war, that the Bush administration walked that back. They said, no, it would be less than $50 billion. And of course, that $200 billion estimate proved to be too low. But there have been credible estimates that the cost of just providing services to the veterans of the Iraq War, just the veterans' benefits, are going to cost $500 billion. If Congress had more information about those costs at the time it was casting, it was making that decision, authorizing the use of force, Congress might have made a better decision. If they had more information, they might not have given the Bush administration that authority. We might have avoided an unnecessary war.
Or if they had accounted for the full cost of that decision
exactly.
At the outset. I see what you're saying. If you're just joining us, we're talking about reshaping the VA in the wake of these revelations about the secret wait lists and other management failures at the VA. Our guests are Michael Cannon, who's Director of Health Policy Studies with the Cato Institute, that's a libertarian think tank, and Professor Ed Dorn, former Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. Professor Dorn, how do you react to Michael Cannon's suggestion here that, you know, part of the problem here is Congress, that Congress doesn't actually account for these issues when it makes the decision to send troops to war?
I agree wholeheartedly in principle that if Congress had known all the facts associated with the war in Iraq, different judgments would have been made. But we don't know whether VA actually is underfunded at this point or whether the resources simply are not being allocated appropriately. We have to be very careful as we go through this not to do anything that's going to prejudge questions about resources and organization. You have to look very closely at the way the system is structured. Are there real systems of accountability in hospitals? Do we know exactly who is responsible for what?
Oh, Michael Cannon, the bigness of the VA is part of your objection to it. Is that right? I mean, it's that your argument would be that this is an opportunity for there to be more private sector involvement, and that would increase efficiency. So you talk a little bit more about what your vision is here.
Well, sure. Big isn't necessarily bad. The problem is that Congress isn't very good at dealing with big. And if you look at the VA, you see a lot of classic problems that you'll see in other socialized, and even supporters of the Veterans Health Administration will use that word. They'll say it's a socialized healthcare system.
It is because the costs are distributed.
Right.
The costs are distributed over a number of people. They're not solely borne by the people directly affected.
Right. So it's also run by a government agency and funded by Congress. So the problem is that you have people who pay little or nothing for medical care. So there's no cost consciousness. There's no check on demand. And Congress only provides a limited amount of resources. So you'll always get shortages in enterprises like this. And you'll also get gluts. You know, the VA has some facilities that are not being used and not being used optimally, and shortages in other areas. One of the great benefits of a market system is that it uses prices in order to eliminate gluts and shortages, so that if there are not enough psychiatrists in one area, prices will go up. That'll draw more psychiatrists to the area. You don't get that in a centrally planned system like the Veterans Health Administration. The information that the bureaucrats get, it takes much longer for them to get the information about where the shortages are, and it's much harder for them to move the resources to where they need to be.
Okay, so give me an idea, a final thought from you, as briefly as you can. Give me an idea of what your vision is for
the future. Congress should try to solve both problems with the VA. First, the one that I mentioned before, they should pre-fund veterans' benefits so that they are less eager to go to war, and that'll be the most important thing they can do to protect our veterans. And number two, I think they should do so in a way that allows for market mechanisms to avoid the problems that we're seeing right now and allows veterans to fire their insurance company or their healthcare providers if they're receiving lousy service. That's something they cannot do with the VA right now.
And Dorn, a final thought from you.
Well, I'm not nearly as sanguine as Michael Cannon is about the efficiency of the private healthcare system. In fact, anybody who's been in a hospital recently and has seen his bill would wonder about what seemed to be absolutely arbitrary pricing mechanisms. So I'm not sure that privatizing anything is a solution. They do need to look at resources and at the allocation of resources. They need to look at organization. That is it clear who is responsible for what? They need to look at metrics. Are we measuring the right things? They need to look at incentives. Are we rewarding people for doing the right things, or are we inviting sort of a collapse of integrity among our managers? That's going to take quite a while, but this is an opportunity to look at a large system, which, by the way, actually functions pretty well in spite of this recent scandal. So I'm not sure this is a situation in which we have to tear the whole thing apart and start all over again.
Ed Dorn is a former Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. He's now Professor of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. We reached him in Austin, Texas. Michael Cannon is Director of Health Policy Studies with the Cato Institute. That's a libertarian think tank here in Washington, D.C., and he joined us from there. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
Just ahead, these days, young Asian American boys have everybody from Yahoo co-founder Jerry Yang to NBA player Jeremy Lin to look up to. But when writer Alex Tizon moved here from the Philippines as a boy, he says all he felt about being Asian was shame.
The Asian faces that I saw on the news, they were faces that looked very similar to mine. They were the face of the enemy.
The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist talks about his search for his Asian self. That's the subject of his new memoir, Big Little Man. And that's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I do my job perfectly, I will probably kill you.
On the next Fresh Air, Shep Gordon talks about his life as a Hollywood insider. After a chance encounter with Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix, he became the manager for Alice Cooper, Blondie, and Pink Floyd. He's influenced countless stars and is the subject of a new documentary by Mike Myers, who also joins us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Tonight at 7 on the Evening Concert on WILL FM 90.9. It's Fiesta, with back-to-back episodes focused on Latin American symphonic music, with Villa-Lobos' 6th Symphony, Ginastera's Pampeana No. 7, and Moncayo's Huayapan. That's Monuments of Latin American Symphonic Music and Painting with Sounds Symphonic Tone Poems on Fiesta. Tonight at 7 on the Evening Concert on WILL FM 90.9.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Let's turn to a conversation you might have been having at home or with friends after some frightening recent events. 2 weeks ago, 22-year-old Elliot Roger killed 6 people and himself near the campus of the University of California, Santa Barbara. And just last week, 26-year-old Aaron Ibarra shot 3 students, killing 1, at Seattle Pacific University. And you, like many people, might have been asking yourself, what about their families? Did they know something? Is there something they could have done differently? It turns out that events like this haunt families for years, according to Catherine Newman, and she would know. She is the author of the book Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. She wrote about this issue recently for the Washington Post, and she's also Dean of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Newman, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
So after doing this work, have you observed any common thread that ties together the families of the perpetrators?
Some of them were aware, many of them were aware that their children were troubled. But Most had no idea that their children were this troubled because they don't have a large sample to compare them to. They've got one kid or two kids, and they might know that Johnny's not as happy as Janie, but they don't have 1,000 people to compare him against. And so they try to, like all good parents do, they try to find a way with Johnny. I even think that the mother of the Newtown shooter was probably working with guns because that's what her son was interested in, and she was trying to reach a very difficult child to reach.
Thinking about the Santa Barbara killer, Elliot Rodger, who was living independently. He was living in a college community. He was living with roommates. I think one of the reasons that that recent event was so upsetting to people, despite the loss of life and, you know, obviously the pain that it is causing, is that it seems as though his parents were aware that he was very troubled because they had him engaged in some kind of therapeutic experience on an ongoing basis. And they did reach out to authorities. Is there anything, I have to ask, is there anything else you think they could have done knowing what we know now?
In all honesty, I think it's very hard to put any blame on the parents in this case. As you noted, Elliot Rodger had been under psychiatric treatment since he was 8 years old. And by the time he reached 22, I have no doubt his parents were looking to provide some opportunity for him to become more independent. And they were looking to see if he could find his way into some kind of adult life. And sadly and tragically, that turned out not to be the case. He was just too disturbed. But they did let the authorities know. His mental health experts let the authorities know. And for a variety of reasons having mostly to do with the restrictions on search and seizure, they didn't go very far in looking into what he had in his house.
Can we go back to the families for a minute? What are some of the things they experience?
First of all, they end up unable to have any privacy at all because everyone is looking for answers, and they usually go to the family first. How could this family have produced a killer is the question on everyone's mind, and that is especially true in small-town America where actually most of these shootings happen because these are very tight-knit communities, and people know each other, or they think they do. And so the question of how this family could have, quote, produced a shooter is foremost on everyone's mind. And, of course, these families are often deep in grief themselves, not only for the loss of the children in their community, but the loss of their own child and the recognition that their own child was far more disturbed than they realized or could deal with.
Richard Martinez, who's the father of one of Roger's victims, in fact, I think he's the father of the last victim, actually reached out to Elliot Rodger's parents, and I believe he met with them. Is that unusual?
Extremely unusual. I can't recall another example of that. There was one family that we studied that was extremely well-loved in the community, thought of as pillars of the community, church-going lawyer, homemaker mother. The community gathered around their home all the time. Kids always came over to their house. They were embraced by their community. They really were. But many of these families experience ostracism. Some of them head for the hills and try never to be found by anyone again. We see all kinds of reactions, and those reactions do derive from feeling guilt, shame, ostracism, and often they are the subject of a lot of plaguing by outsiders.
Is there anything, finally, that you would wish us to learn or think about as a general public in response to these recent events, which, as you said, seem to be, you know, part of a very disturbing cycle, you know, at the moment? I mean, I know that we have not addressed the whole question of gun control and access to guns, and I do recognize that we have not done so. I know that there are some people who will feel that we have completely missed the point, but that is a broader conversation that we just don't have time for. But I just wonder, are there things you would wish us to be thinking about, whatever they are?
There are two things that I think are important. One is that although Elliot Rodger's family made every effort to alert authorities and to gain their help, most of the time in these shootings, people don't do that. There are warning signs around them that something is going wrong. Many of the children we interviewed, teenagers that we interviewed, didn't go to school on the day when the shooting happened because they knew something horrible was going to happen, but they didn't tell anybody. So the most important thing is that when young people who have a pretty good radar for something not quite right, you know, feel afraid, they need to come forward and tell people. It won't always work. Sadly, in the Elliot Rodger case, it didn't. His parents tried everything to get others to intervene, and we're going to have to do a lot of soul searching about why that didn't work. But most of the time, these things can be prevented if the authorities know. and very often they don't know. The second thing is that we should not assume that what we see on the surface is always telling us what lies underneath. Many of these young shooters have deeply troubled imaginations. They let people know in so many ways that they're not quite right in the world. And young people often push their buttons, sadly. They don't accept them. They ostracize them. And that just causes them to seek a stage for glory. And that is part of the toxic recipe for these terrible shootings. We could all be a little bit more forgiving, a little more kindly, a little less bullying. And adolescence is a particularly difficult time for most young people.
Catherine Newman is Dean of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University and the author of the book Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. She actually was kind enough to go to our bureau in New York. Professor Newman, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
We recently mourned the death of the poet and writer Maya Angelou. She was known for many things, but perhaps most for mining the details of her life to tell the bigger story of being born Black, female, and poor in America, and the story of how she came not just to survive, but thrive and love all those parts of herself. Now comes a story in a similar vein from someone of a very different background. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Alex Tizon immigrated from the Philippines as a boy. His parents, like so many, came for a better life. But at some point, he realized that so much of what he saw and heard around him told him that what he was, an Asian man, was shameful, weak, and at the bottom of the manhood hierarchy. But after many years of thinking about his own story and writing those of others, Tizon found a new narrative, and in his new memoir, he tells that story. His book is titled Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self, and Alex Tizon is with us now from member station KLCC, which is in Eugene, Oregon. Alex, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Michelle. It's a pleasure.
I want to start with the fireplace story. You know, your
family. Oh my.
Yeah. Your family left the Philippines. You moved to L.A. And then tell me about the fireplace story.
We came to a country with fireplaces. And we came from a country in the Philippines where indoor fireplaces didn't exist. So we didn't know how they worked. So our very first house in Seattle, we moved in. My father loved that fireplace, and he built this roaring fire on a Christmas night. We all went to bed that night, and he closed the vent in the fireplace, not knowing that the logs that were burning in there had been emitting these carbon monoxide fumes. The short story is that on that Christmas Eve night, actually, we all came close to dying from carbon monoxide poisoning. Hmm. It was profound in that we were having our very first purely American moment. We were trying to have a Christmas, but we didn't make it through, or we almost didn't make it through that night.
It almost killed you. And it became kind of a metaphor for all of you in the family as the years went on. And what you say in the book, quote, "Our early years in America were marked by relentless self-annihilation, though of course we did not see it that way at the time." The drama of your lives and your family, the families like yours, is that you were pulled here, but then what you found here, in a way, required you to kind of erase yourself.
That's absolutely right. I think that that is common to many, many immigrants and to many minority groups. I think that part of the process of assimilating into the larger mainstream white culture entails annihilating parts of ourselves. But that, of course, that word annihilation wasn't the way we saw it as it was happening.
One of the big themes of your book is that the fundamental fact of life, of your life as a young Asian man particularly, was shame. Let me read from the book. "In the America that I grew up in, men of Asia placed last in the hierarchy of manhood. They were invisible in the high testosterone arenas of politics and big business and sports, on television and in the movies. They were worse than invisible. They were embarrassing. We were embarrassing. The Asian male in cinema was synonymous with nebbish. They made great extras in crowd scenes that required running away. Asian men excelled. They certainly did not play strong male lead roles because apparently there were no strong Asian males with sex appeal. On the public sex appeal scale, the Asian men did not even register." How did you start to experience it? I mean, going back, you know, to early when you first got here.
Television and movies were our biggest teachers. When we came to the United States, the Vietnam War was just ratcheting up. And so the Asian faces that I saw on the news, they were the face of the enemy. Asian men, particularly, were either small, ineffective, or they were evil. And those messages were deeply, deeply embedded in me for many years.
You know, growing up, you kept this file in the garage of your family's house, and whenever you found something, tell me about the file that you kept.
Well, you know, in retrospect, I see that I inherited that habit from my mother, who was a great filer. Anytime she found something that she wanted to remember, she put it in a file. And I just started doing the same thing when I was about 13 or 14. I started cutting out articles that had to do with Asia or Asians. We were called Orientals at the time. I started putting them in files, and after some time, these files started getting fatter and fatter. I still have those files, and now they occupy several large, tall filing cabinets. Looking back on it, I see that I was trying to find something. I was trying to find my own worth as a man and as an Asian man.
Did you feel very alone in that quest?
I felt very alone, only because I didn't know. I didn't know what I was going through, and I didn't know how to reach out to other people. But it turns out that many, many, many Asian men go through this very same thing growing up. The internet has changed everything, because a lot of these men are now connecting with each other and communicating with each other, and it's a common theme among Asian men in the West, particularly immigrant Asian men. The homegrown Asians, they're a different story.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Alex Tizon. We're talking about his new memoir, Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. What do you think started to change your perception of yourself as an Asian man? Was it what was going on around you and seeing other people who look like you making their mark? Or was it something within you where you started to make your mark in your field, in journalism?
The answer to that is that they were both happening at the same time. I was finding my own way, started figuring out who I was and what I was good at, found a thing that I could be good at and make a living at, which was being a journalist. And that really helped me become a more solid person with a solid identity. At the same time that was happening to me in the 80s, the world did start to begin to change, and there were these Asian and Asian American men and women who were starting to excel. I was finding value in me and seeing Ichiro Suzuki of the Mariners, meeting the two governors from Hawaii, Ben Cayetano and Gary Locke in Washington, and seeing these new Asian athletes excel, Yao Ming from Houston Rockets, Jeremy Lin with the New York Knicks, Manny Pacquiao of the Philippines. Seeing these Asian men exude strength helped me corroborate what I longed for my whole life, which was this sense that, yes, Asian men, given the opportunity, can compete at the highest levels in those high testosterone arenas.
There are more and more stories like this, like yours, coming out. I think yours, where people are saying, no, this is, you don't really know me. This is what it's like to be me. Why do you feel this is happening now?
The first big wave of Asians coming to America in the modern era, it began in the 60s. And like me, a lot of a lot of the people who are writing about this and speaking about it now are people who were children in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And so we're just coming into our own. And so part of it is just a timing thing. We started coming in the 60s and 70s. Now we're grown-up people with things to say.
How do you feel now that you got it out?
Well, you know, I just read this wonderful quote by Maya Angelou. Actually, the day that she died, all these wonderful quotes came up. I'm going to paraphrase it, but basically what she said was that there's no worse agony than keeping an untold story inside you. And that really struck me as pertinent, relevant to me, because that's what I had. I had an untold story that I kept inside me, and it was contained and bottled up, and it didn't feel so good. That's the kind of stuff that grows like cancer inside you, I think. So getting it out feels better than good. It's almost like a cosmic release for me. The best part of this is the sense of not feeling so alone. Connecting with other people who have felt similarly. Other people from other groups. Very, very different kinds of people who connect with that loneliness and that isolation and that sense of being on the outside. You know what? We're all in the same boat.
Alex Tizon is author of the new memoir, Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. He was a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and a longtime staffer at the Seattle Times, and he's currently teaching at the University of Oregon. Alex, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, 30 years after Bob Marley and the Wailers released their iconic album, Legend, their music and their purpose still resonate.
The song One Love is talking to the people of the world, telling them to get it together. No more war, only peace. Love is the solution.
The Wailers performed that and other classic songs in a special in-studio performance and conversation that you do not want to miss. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org. From the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. From the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is an appreciation of public radio and its commitment to introducing music to all walks of life. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
So who's going to win the World Cup this year?
U.S.
Germany!
Okay, these kids play soccer, but World Cup fever is a real thing.
If you don't watch sports, if you're like a music fan, it's like Michael Jackson, like the Beatles, and like Prince performing together. How are you going to miss that?
Getting pumped for the 2014 World Cup. That's next time on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Coming to WILL-TV, join host Michael Palin as he visits Brazil for the very first time and embarks on a journey across the fifth largest country in the world. Taking up over half of South America, Brazil is a mix of races, religions, wealth, poverty, and unexplored wilderness. This four-part series takes you from the lost world of Amazonia to the buzzing metropolis of Rio de Janeiro. Watch Brazil with Michael Palin tonight at 8 on WILL-TV.
WILL programming is made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 66 years. The Hendrick House Dining Facility, with Gold LEED certification, grows produce on its green roof and in its farm plot and supports local farmers. More information is available at 365-8000.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Okay, you can be real with me. I know you or somebody you know spent some of the weekend binge-watching Orange is the New Black. The Netflix original series returns to prison for a second season, delving into the lives of incarcerated women, including transgender prisoner Sophia Bursette, played by transgender actress and activist Laverne Cox. Laverne Cox has been making quite a splash of late. She was featured recently on the cover of Time magazine, becoming the first transgender person to snag that spot. When we caught up with her last year, we talked about a lot of things, and she also shared the music she loves for a regular feature called In Your Ear.
Hi, my name is Laverne Cox, and one of the songs that I'm really loving right now is Taylor Swift's I Knew You Were Trouble. Once upon a time, a few mistakes.
mistakes ago. I was in your sights. You got me alone. You found me. You found me. You found me. I guess you didn't.
And the reason I love that song is that it's a great reminder to me that usually the men who come into my life who are trouble, they show me right away.
I knew you were trouble when you walked in. So shame on me now. Blew me to places I've never been. Now I'm lying on the cold, hard ground. Oh, oh, trouble, trouble, trouble.
It's my job to just listen, to see the red flags, listen to what they're saying to me, and run the other way. So I love that Taylor Swift song for that reason. Another song I'm listening to right now and loving is from an independent recording artist by the name of Mila Jam, and the song is called Master of the Universe. It features a sample from the old, like, 80s Tetris game. And the song is such a great workout song for me and just makes me feel empowered and like I'm the master of my own universe. Mila Jam, Master of the Universe. It rocks.
Cause you gotta do what you gotta do.
Sing!
Everyone in your own power. When love comes around, no, it's only fire. Let the music give you power. Fight for the rhythm of a system solar. You're the one that loves you first. You don't have to make it work. We are the chosen ones.
Another song that I'm listening to and loving is an old song by Beyoncé called Dance For You. And I put the video on and, like, danced to the song in my apartment, and it makes me feel really sexy. It's great when, like, I have a date coming up or something, and it just makes me feel really sexy and strong and wonderful. Dance For You, Beyoncé. So good.
That was actress and transgender activist Laverne Cox telling us what's playing in her ear. To hear our previous conversation with her, you can go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then Tell Me More. If you are a fan of reggae, and you know what? Even if you aren't, then you certainly know Bob Marley and the Wailers.
I wanna love you and treat you right. I wanna love you every day and every night. We'll be together.
That was Is This Love? It is from Legend, the album released after Bob Marley's untimely death. Time magazine named it the best album of the 20th century, and it is still the standard by which reggae music is defined for millions around the world. Now, the Wailers are celebrating the 30th anniversary of that iconic album. The group is touring the U.S. now, and they were kind enough to stop by our studios in Washington, D.C. for a special conversation and in-studio performance. Welcome. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for the invitation.
Mm-hmm. I understand that Dwayne Danglin Anglin on lead vocals, and you are going to introduce everybody with it. Will you introduce everybody for us, please?
Sure. First and foremost, background vocalist, Ms. CG Victory.
Hello.
Guitarist, lead guitarist, Mr. Audley Chisholm. And on lead with myself, Mr. Kevin Davey.
All right.
Otherwise known as Ivad.
All right, welcome. Thank you all. And I think somebody's missing here. Mr. Barrett is missing. He's on tour with you. He's not doesn't happen to be here you know, at the moment. You know, to that point, though, people have come and gone from the Wailer since its inception in 1969, and you joined in 2010. Do I have that right?
Yes.
And you are actually a Navy veteran. Do I have that right?
Yes.
With a master's degree in criminology. It's kind of a different background. I'm just interested in what drew you to this phase of your life.
Music, I mean, I've always loved Bob Marley and the Wailers in particular. I mean, growing up in Jamaica, that's kind of like, you know, it's inborn because a radio is a big part of Jamaica. In most places, people only listen to the radio on their commute to work or at work. In Jamaica, you listen to radio at home. It's one of the only places that really does that. So, and every day you hear Bob Marley and the Wailers on the radio. Even to this day, every radio station plays at least one or two. So, you know, it's a part of me. And so I started doing music very late. I think it was as a rebellion of being in the military, being on a ship 90 days at a time, you need something. And that was the thing, my outlet. You know, through God's blessings, I'm singing with the Wailers now. So, I mean, that's not a mistake. It has to be something that was predestined. Now I see exactly what he means to people, his music and the Wailers' music, and it's more of an honor and a privilege now than it was before.
Let's play something, and then we'll talk some more. Okay, what are you going to play first? I think you're going to do One Love.
Yeah.
All right, let's hear it. Thank you.
One love, one heart, let's get together and feel all right. Hear the children crying,
one love.
Hear the children crying,
one love.
We give thanks and praise to the Lord, and I will feel all right. Singing, let's get together and feel all right. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Let them all pass all their dirty remarks.
One love.
There is one question I'd really love to ask.
One heart.
Is there a place for that hopeless sinner who has hurt all mankind just to save his own beliefs? One love. What about the one heart?
One heart.
What about the let's get together and feel alright? As it was in the beginning,
one love,
so shall it be in the end.
One night,
all
right. Give thanks and praise to the Lord,
and I will feel alright. Singing, let's get together and feel alright.
Let's get together to fight the holy Armageddon.
One love.
So when the man comes, there will be no doom.
One heart.
Have pity on those whose chances grow thinner. There ain't no hiding place from the Father of creation. Singing,
one love.
What about the one heart?
One heart.
What about the let's get together and feel alright? Hear the children crying.
One love.
Hear the children crying.
One heart.
We give thanks and praise to the Lord, and I will feel alright. Singing, let's get together and feel alright. We give thanks and praise to the Lord, and I will feel alright. Singing, let's get together and feel alright. We give thanks and praise to the Lord, and I will feel alright.
If you're just joining us, we are having a special performance and in-studio conversation with the iconic reggae group The Wailers. They're on tour in the U.S. right now and celebrating the 30th anniversary of their album, Legend. I had the opportunity to interview a former prime minister of Jamaica who explained that this song was first performed in the middle of a lot of election violence.
Right.
And it was in part a message of let's stop all this. And I was just wondering about what, when you perform the song, what do you want people to draw from it? Yvonne, do you want to speak on this?
The song One Love is talking to the people of the world, you know, telling them to get it together. No more war, only peace. Love is the solution. The Earth crisis, the things that we go through here, we need that perfect one, love. It's a very lively song. It's a party song. It's a happy song. It's a song that just takes you out of your lower vibration and bring you up, lift you up, you know what I mean? So it's for every vibe, every situation.
Dwayne, what about you?
The whole theme of One Love is just bringing, you know, allowing people to understand that regardless of your background or your race, we are all one people. There is no separation between black and white, Asian or Indian or Latino. We're all just people. But we sing music for people. So the people who need it the most is the people who are hearing it, not the people that are singing
it.
So it is your song, not the Wheeler's song.
Interesting. To that end, I wanted to ask if you would play another song, Redemption Song. I would love to hear that. Is that good?
World pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hands were made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs.
Separate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, for none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing another song of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs, the songs of freedom.
Redemption songs.
Forgive me, I hope you don't mind my mentioning that all of you are young.
Yeah.
You know, you're young. You are not of Mr. Marley's era, right? Right. He would be an elder now,
right,
had he stayed with us. You know, some people, when they embrace the work of an earlier era, they feel in a way that they're ambassadors of that work to the next generation. What do you think?
The work is already done, and I think that the work is very prophetic. It will always be here with us to guide us and to show us the way.
Mm. What's next for you, or what would you want us to be thinking about as we bid farewell for now?
The whole theme of this music is about positive vibrations. Because if you can get people to think in a positive way, there can be no negative.
One love, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think the legacy of the music would mean nothing if people didn't understand what positive vibrations mean.
Or believe it.
You understand? Positive vibrations is about giving thanks and understanding that everybody in this world belongs there. On any tour, on any given year, that is our theme.
Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you so much. I think that you're going to go out on a song that I think everybody knows, even if they don't know the title. I didn't actually know the title of it. I knew the song, but I didn't know the title until you all were coming. Isn't that funny? It's Three Little Birds, and we have been visiting with the Wailers, and they were kind enough to take a break on their U.S. tour to come and see us here in our studio in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much for coming, and I think we are going to hear Three Little Birds. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Don't worry about a thing, 'cause every little thing is gonna be alright. Singing, don't worry about a thing, don't you worry, 'cause every little thing is gonna be alright. Rise up this morning, smile with your rising sun. Three little birds beats by my door, sir, singing sweet songs, a melody's pure and true. Singing, this is my message to you. Singing, don't worry about a thing, 'cause every little thing is gonna be alright. We're singing, don't worry about a thing, don't you worry, 'cause every little thing is gonna be alright.
I rise up this morning, smile with the rising sun. Three little birds